If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the final episode of 1865, the audio drama, season two. I'm Rob McCollum, one of the producers and the director of 1865 audio drama. Thank you for listening all the way through, and thank you for coming back one last time to join us on this final Inside the Episode, episode 10. And speaking of one last time, joining me as always, Eric Archilla and Stephen Walters. Guys, congratulations. We did it.
Woo.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, thank you, Rob.
And thank you to the audience for going on this journey with us. It's been a lot of work, but it's been tremendously gratifying to see all of your love and support online. We make these stories for you. And so thank you for your support.
Yeah, and as we talked about at the beginning of the season, we weren't planning on doing a season two. We had tied the knot. We'd wrapped it up. And because of fan support and people wanting more, and supporting us on Patreon. If you're not a member of Patreon, that's Patreon/1865podcast. But because of that support, we were able to consider doing a season two.
And I'm really glad we did, honestly. So yeah. Thank you all. Thank you for your support.
I am also really glad we did. I love that we've gotten to learn about this amazing new character, Ulysses S. Grant, from a different perspective than I think a lot of people know him. So I'm super happy we did it. But I know, Steve and Eric both, there were some times mid-season where you were less than happy that we did it, because this turned out to be a real writing challenge this season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, one of the biggest challenges is that we changed the way we were distributing the episode mid-stride. The original plan was to release it as three little miniseries, 3 to 4 episodes each. The first chapter would be about, you know, putting Grant back into the impeachment story of Andrew Johnson. The second chapter would be about Grant's war with the KKK. And the third and final chapter would be about the whiskey ring. Of course, that held, but we just sort of had to compress the timeline. And so we were sort of in a state of hurry up almost from the beginning. And then on top of that, as Dr. Greg Jackson and Dr. Ray Christian have both talked about as our guests on these Inside the Episodes, this era of American history is often misunderstood. And one of the reasons for that is it's incredibly complex. The political landscape is very nuanced, fractured, and complicated. There are not a lot of sort of one-to-one analogs that can help modern audiences understand. As Greg mentioned, there's this sort of misconception that once the Civil War was won and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, that it was like, okay, everything's equal now. And of course, we know that's not true. The historical record shows us that, you know, the fight for equality and justice did begin the moment that Lincoln was shot. And of course, it continued all the way up through the 1960s, and it continues today. That work is still not done. And we see that with some of these restrictive voting rights access laws that are being passed in the wake of the 2020 election. You know, we see that in the rise of white supremacy. So these complications and conflicts that General Grant was up against are still with us today.
I was really amazed when we were recording the speech from Joseph Rainey that he made at the floor of the House of Representatives, that speech could have been given today.
Yeah. And, you know, I did not change very much about that speech. I think I only added one line at the end where he says, "We will not stop until we see these rights afforded us." But other than that, those were Rainey's actual words. And we did that wherever we could throughout the series with all of the characters.
So leading up to 10, a lot of question that you guys had in terms of when you wanted to reveal things to the audience. There was a lot of back and forth, and I think it's interesting the choices that you guys made and why you made them.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to, Rob, is the Sylph letter, right?
The Sylph letter and kind of Babcock's journey through this.
Yeah, so what I ultimately landed on is that I wanted the audience and Grant to be in alignment, right? Like, I didn't want the audience ahead of Grant too far or behind Grant too far. I wanted them to be in sort of lockstep. And I also wanted the audience to have the experience that Grant must have had about the Whiskey Ring investigation, because in the real history of it, he was made to believe that Henderson was a partisan actor. He was made to believe that Babcock was innocent and was being framed. He was made to believe that Benjamin Bristow had political ambitions and was that everything he was doing was for a third term. He was betrayed and lied to. And as Dr. Jackson mentioned in the last Inside the episode, Grant was an honest man and projected that honesty onto others. And so we felt that the best way to do that was to withhold the reveal about the Sylph letter until after Grant testified for him, so that it felt more like a betrayal, so that at the moment when Grant found out the truth, the audience also found out the truth. And we were like, hey, if the audience wonders about Babcock, if they're questioning Babcock, or hey, if they get online and Google it, that's totally fine. But we wanted the audience to see what Grant was experiencing. Now, I should say that in the real history of it, the Sylph letter came into the investigation relatively early. And so, but this is part of the reason why we did what we did, is because after that Sylph letter, this is the part of Grant that I find so frustrating. After that Sylph letter came into the investigation and Babcock admitted that he did write the Sylph letter, his explanation, which we get into a little bit in this episode, is he said, well, yeah, I wrote it, but it was just a joke because the guy that I wrote it to, this man, General McDonald, and the real history of it, you know, he introduced me to this woman. And so it was like this inside joke between us. But we weren't talking about the Whiskey Ring. We were talking about something completely different. Meanwhile, the guy that he wrote it to is like, you know, the mob boss, basically.
Yeah, the head of the ring. Yeah.
Who's also one of Grant's close friends. And so it becomes so difficult for me to understand how Grant could not have been suspicious of Babcock, you know, this willful ignorance, I guess you could call it. And because of that, we decided we wanted to withhold that piece of information. We wanted to leave it a question to make it more complicated for the audience. And if anything, we wanted to sort of prejudice them against Henderson in the ways that Babcock prejudiced Grant against Henderson.
Yeah, that situation caused a critical fail in the brain of Steve Walters.
It did. Oh, boy.
He just couldn't wrap his head around, like, Grant had to either be an idiot or had to be complicit, because how else could you buy that excuse from Orville Babcock that the telegram was?
Rob and I, we were talking the other day. We were talking about this question, and Rob, you were like, well, Grant's not an idiot. And I just blurted out, I was like, I think he might have been.
Yeah, you were so frustrated. I know there was late night calls to Eric. There were late night porch sessions with me. You were on the phone with Greg Jackson. It was a lot of wrestling. But I think the decision to leave the moment where Grant finds out to be also the moment where the audience finds out that Babcock was complicit and that Grant was duped, I feel like that's, as a storyteller, way more satisfying than being too far ahead.
Yeah, and Steve embraced the, why did Grant feel this way? Let's let the audience and us go on that journey of why did he believe him in relation to all of the politics of the time. All of the political attacks they were dealing with.
Well, and we talked about different versions of it. I think the audience might like to know this. We talked about one version where we were going to let the audience know pretty early that Babcock was guilty, and we were going to get to see Babcock being an Iago figure, which if you go back and listen to episode 9, then you may see him doing that in ways that you didn't the first time.
Being very Machiavellian.
Right. Or if you did know the history and you knew what he was doing, then you're already ahead of me on this. But you know, I think that the reason we did not want to do that in the end is because anytime the audience is not aligned with your protagonist, I think that it's problematic, especially in a story about honesty and betrayal and trust. It just felt ultimately like the right thing to do.
And so that betrayal by Babcock and Grant's realization that he has been betrayed once again by the men of Washington, at least in your telling, is the reason Grant decides not to stand for election.
Yeah.
He's heartbroken.
He's heartbroken, and he also feels like he's failed the country. And I have Grant say something to the effect of, you know, I know how to win a war on the field of battle, but I'm the wrong general for this fight because I don't know how to fight an enemy that smiles in my face while they stick the knife in my back. And there actually is some truth in this. Like, in the real history of it, Grant did submit his official public declination letter in the middle of the Whiskey Ring. Greg Jackson and I had a long talk about that decision that he made to do it. It was before he knew for sure that Babcock was a bad actor. And I think there's actually some question about whether he ever really knew it for sure. We can talk about that too. But I moved the timing of it. I moved his decision to send that declination letter from the middle of the Whiskey Ring, which is where it really was in history. I moved it to after the moment of betrayal. But Greg and I talked about this, and Greg said, no, I think he was disgusted by the Whiskey Ring scandal because it was the last and biggest of a long list of scandals. And like you said, Eric, he was heartbroken by all of it. And it broke him, you know, it broke his spirits. And I think in our telling of it, at least, it broke his will to finish the fight, which is, of course, a source of great frustration to Joseph Rainey and the Freedmen.
So Grant has made this very difficult decision not to stand. And that has very real consequences for the future of the country.
Yeah, I mean, the word Grant has become synonymous with corruption. His party wants to run in a completely different direction. They end up settling on a compromise candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, who's sort of a Washington outsider at the time, a governor of Ohio, who is a man who makes it known that he is willing to sort of broker a deal of peace and reconstruction on the South's terms, more or less. He lets the folks of Washington, the people in the halls of power, he lets them know about this long in advance of the actual election of 1876. But then, of course, the election of 1876 is a total disaster. It's one of the most corrupt elections in American history. It's too close to call. It comes down to a handful of states, one of which is Florida, which, of course, that probably sounds familiar to a lot of people listening. And ultimately, it's too close to call. It gets kicked to the House of Representatives, and this Faustian bargain is made between the Democrats and the Republicans. There's a lot of historians that would argue that the Democrats actually won that election, won both the popular vote and the electoral vote, but that due to some, you know, partisan chicanery and some electioneering, the Republicans were able to make it too close to call. That also might sound familiar to some modern audiences. But the result of it is this deal that's called the Compromise of 1877. Long and short of it is, Republicans agree to pull all federal troops out of the South and put an end to Reconstruction. In exchange, the Democrats relinquish the White House to Rutherford B. Hayes and the Republicans.
And the most tragic part of that deal is that they are going to leave the Freedmen of the South to the governance of the Southern states.
Or home rule is what that was called.
Home rule.
Yeah, so home rule is the new order of the day. The days of Grant pushing for Reconstruction are over. It's the Freedmen who pay the price. And we dramatize that in a fictionalized scene between Joseph Rainey and Rose Williams, who we bring back. Very glad that we got to put Sidney James Harcourt, who's, of course, an original cast member from Hamilton, an incredibly gifted actor, and put him in another scene with one of my favorite actresses on the planet, Kelly Jenrette.
And Joseph Rainey, actually, not long after that compromise, will lose his seat.
Because of electioneering on the ground in the South, because of these, you know, basically these paramilitary organizations that are scaring Black folks away from the polls down South. And Joseph Rainey makes an incredible speech on the floor of the House talking about why he lost his seat.
Kelly is amazing in her portrayal of Rose. And I think the Rose story itself is so amazing. And just wanted you to fill the audience in a little bit about what little we know about what happened to Rose after all of this went down.
So we know that the Grant administration had arrested hundreds and hundreds of KKK members and
thousands.
And because of this deal, very few of them saw any prosecution. Once the North pulled out, that was it. So we see that Dr. Bratton never actually sees any jail time because of what he did.
He's able to come back to York County. And we don't know hardly, there's almost no historical documentation about what Rose Williams' life was like after her husband died. But presumably, for as far as Eric was able to tell from the census, it seems that her and Dr. Bratton lived out the rest of their lives in the same town.
One other voice that we get to hear in this episode that we haven't heard in quite a while is that of Langston, who has been out of our story for some time, but we have a scene with Garfield and Langston here.
Yeah, and part of the reason that Langston kind of disappeared this season is Will Harper, the actor who plays Langston, was really busy shooting an HBO show, but we were able to get him for episode 10, and that was really crucial because of, well, spoiler alert, I think that that's where the next chapter of the story is headed, is John Mercer Langston's character. In this particular scene, though, what we're dramatizing is this idea that, you know, first of all, we learn that James Garfield has had a little bit of a turn, that, you know, the man who we have at least painted is always making a political choice, for once makes a moral choice. He walks out of the room. He doesn't participate in the Compromise of 1877 because he doesn't think it's right. And that is a bit of a change for James Garfield, at least in the way that we have portrayed him. But then what we also learn is that Langston is fed up. He is sick and tired of the duplicity of Washington, the failure of the white leadership, and he has sought an appointment to be U.S. Minister to Haiti. And so he's going to leave the country and go off and try to make a new life for himself and his family.
Yeah, and at this time, Haiti and Liberia are these places where there's black self-governance. And so as we saw in earlier episodes, Reverend Elias Hill took that group to Liberia to try to escape the violence of America.
Well, it's a really interesting scene, the dynamic between Garfield and Langston in this. And I wanted to mention the fact that you've had some help from a Dallas writer who's had a really big impact on our story.
Yeah, I brought in a consulting producer to help me with the writing of season two, a playwright named Jonathan Norton, who is the resident playwright of the Dallas Theater Center, the Tony Award-winning theater here in North Texas. Jonathan is an incredible playwright and an incredible human being, and I love his voice as a writer. And so when I was looking for a partner who could, you know, bring some authenticity to the diverse characters in the story, who also had a Southern background, Jonathan was the first writer that came to mind, and it's easily the best decision that me and Eric made this season. Jonathan actually co-wrote episode 10 with me. He consulted on episodes 4 through 9, and then we sort of divided and conquered on this episode, and Jonathan did incredible work, and I'm just so grateful to have him here, and we hope that he's going to be a part of the 1865 family moving forward.
Yes, we were so fortunate to have Jonathan's work on this episode. One scene in particular that I thought was really powerful and must be discussed is we had to give Grant a send-off. We've had to do that now with several major characters, but you chose Ely Parker as the vehicle for this final moment.
Yeah, Jonathan wrote this really beautiful scene between Ely Parker and Grant on his deathbed. Grant had cancer of the throat. It's funny that alcohol was the thing people always pointed the finger at Grant about, but it was the cigars that killed him in the end.
And of course, we set that up early on in the series with the bit where he gives, you know, bets Grant a box of cigars that Johnson won't stand for a second term.
So at this point, Grant had gone on this world tour after his presidency, bankrupted himself, and just was a man without any means. And he finally was convinced by Samuel Clemens,
Mark Twain,
to write his memoirs and make some money to leave behind for his wife, Julia. So he spent the end of his life writing these memoirs before he passed.
I think it's worth saying that, you know, one of the reasons that I, in my cynical read of history, as cynical as I can be, the reason that I've decided that I don't think that Grant was a dishonest actor is because of the fact that he was duped so many times in his life over money. People kept taking advantage of him time and time again, and he kept trusting people time and time again. You know, I think if Grant had retired a wealthy man, you know, if he had left the presidency a wealthy man and then the years that followed profited from his privilege or power, I might be more suspicious of him. But I think he was honest. And I think a lot of times in history, and I think this is true today too, a lot of times honest folks don't have a lot of money. This is not an indictment of capitalism, and I don't want to open up that can of worms, but in a capitalist system, it's hard to come by money, honestly.
Except in podcasting.
Yeah, where there's, as Rob loves to say, tens of dollars to be
there's
made.
There's tens of dollars to be made, honestly, podcasting. So in this final scene, why did you choose Ely Parker to be the voice that was kind of the touchstone from his past on this scene?
I think the relationship between Ely and Grant has always fascinated me. It's one that I, even having done as much research as I've done, it's one that I still don't fully understand, and it's one that I would love to know more about. I know that, you know, it was a big inflection point in Grant's journey to make that political choice. And, you know, it teed up, at least in our telling of the story, his mistake with Ely teed up and reinforced why he was so inclined to trust Babcock, I think.
Yeah, he doubled down because he didn't want to sacrifice another soldier on the battlefield of politics.
Yeah. And so it felt right to me in a story that's ultimately about betrayal to bring back one of the men that was betrayed. And also, we really wanted that last moment with Grant to be a person of color, frankly, someone to give voice to that betrayal. You know, it's just the idea that Grant could even make a choice like that, you know, to put his presidency in peril, to, you know, sacrifice the freedmen all to protect a friend. You know, that's certainly in the 1870s, that's only possible for a white man. So we just felt like it was a very satisfying way to sort of tie it up all together.
Well, and the final thought, the final idea was Ely saying, I think you did your best, but in the end, it wasn't enough. Is that your view? Is that how you would walk away from the Grant story now, having lived with it for so long?
Yes, that is where I've landed. It's a miracle what Grant was able to accomplish, but it's also a devastating disappointment. if that makes any sense. There's a paradox there. It's like if you look at the context of what Grant was up against, it's miraculous what he did. But when you also examine the failures of the Grant administration and the failures of Reconstruction, it's also just incredibly disappointing.
The Ely Parker scene leads us to the passing of Grant, and we have this really beautiful but very troubled eulogy written by Henry Ward Beecher, who is the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe that wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And this was commissioned by Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, who was editing and publishing Grant's memoirs. He commissioned Henry Ward Beecher to write this eulogy, and it's troubling. It sums up our entire season, which is Grant had a fault, and his fault was that he's too trusting. You can't be both a good general and a good politician, that the qualities of those two different offices, it's difficult to find a person that has the capability of doing both.
Yeah.
And I know that that paradox of trying to understand both the victories and the failings of the man was one of the things that made this so interesting to listen to throughout this season, and also so difficult for you guys to write. So thank you guys both for the hours and hours of work.
Thank you. And thank you, Rob, for your great work directing. And, you know, thank you to the listeners for tuning in.
Now, at the risk of triggering you, talking about how hard this season was to write, you mentioned a little earlier that you at least have some thoughts in the back of your mind on what a potential season 3 might look like. Now, I want to tell everybody listening, there is no season 3 planned yet. We have nothing concrete. We have no deals in place. We don't know when it's going to happen, if it's going to happen. But I know from the feedback that you guys have been giving us quite constantly throughout the entire 2 seasons, there is a real interest in continuing this story out there, Steve. So if it were to continue, where might it go?
Well, if you listened all the way to the end of the credits, you probably already know where it's going. The character that I'm the most interested in exploring is John Mercer Langston, who is, you know, ultimately the first Black congressman elected in the state of Virginia, who served in a variety of government positions over the years and who played a pretty big role, not just in the winning of the Civil War, where he recruited Black troops, but in the fight for Reconstruction. And I can tell you that while it is not a guarantee by any means that we'll be able to do this, it's something that I hope that we're able to do. Will Harper is an incredible actor, is a big fan of the show and one of my favorite collaborators. And so some of it will depend on what is possible for Will. Some of it will depend on what is possible financially. But if you're interested in seeing more content and you're interested in seeing where the story might go if we explore John Mercer Langston, you know, one of the ways that you can help make that possible is to support us on Patreon. Become a member on there, and your support will make it more possible, more feasible.
Yes, we know a lot of you have been with us all the way through and listening to the episodes, but if you've not become a Patreon member and you're like, hey, it's all done now, what's the point? That is one of the ways that we will be able to track responses and also build the funds necessary to potentially look at a season 3. So if you are interested and you want to support us, Patreon is the way to do that.
Yeah, and I can also give you an extra incentive for those of you who have been with us all the way through season 1 and 2. If there are any Edwin Stanton fans out there, I can tell you that a story about John Mercer Langston would definitely start in the Civil War, and we all remember who the war secretary was during that time.
So if you want more Stanton, you got to help us get to season 3. Okay, enough. I don't want to stress you guys out anymore thinking about future writing you have to do. We're finally at the point where you can take a victory lap for this incredible and very difficult season. I just want to thank both of you guys for all of the hard work and time and blood and sweat and tears and lack of sleep that it took to get season 2 over the finish line.
Well, what makes it all worth it, I know I say this a lot, but I say it because it's true, is the audience. We make it for you, you know, your engagement and your excitement and the interactions that we have with you on social media and the feedback that we get. That's what keeps us going. So thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. And we hope to bring you more.
Guys, thank you so much for this entire season and for once again joining us on Inside the Episode 1865.
Always a pleasure, Rob.
Thanks, Rob.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at 1865 Podcast for more inside information and true history from the show. And if you really want to help us out, you're a big fan of the show, please help us out. Become a patron at patreon.com/1865podcast. Members there get exclusive content, early access, ad-free listening, so much more cool stuff there. We're always looking for more ways to give back to our Patreon community, so you can become a member at patreon.com/1865. 1865 is an Airship production. This episode is hosted by me, Rob McCollum, produced by Eric Archilla, audio editing by Molly Bach, theme music by Lindsey Graham. Thank you for being here for Inside the Episode 1865.